I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Winter is fast approaching. Anchorage saw a dusting of snow yesterday, and the temperatures are now falling below freezing in many areas. Housing for people who have been sleeping outdoors becomes more urgent this time of year. And as the chronic shortage of affordable housing persists across the state, new complications such as the federal government shutdown and the sudden housing crisis in the Kuskokwim region are adding pressure to plans for helping Alaskans find shelter for winter. What are state and city leaders working on, and how can people help? The ongoing need for safe, affordable housing is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. As the snow line creeps down the Chugach Range in South Central, it's a clear reminder that winter is starting to clamp down. And now it's not only uncomfortable to sleep outdoors, it can be life-threatening. What is the outlook for this winter, both for Alaska's largest city and other communities across our state? The federal government shutdown is nearing a month with no end in sight. How is the lack of federal program support, payroll, food assistance, and payment to service providers deepening the risk of people becoming vulnerable to homelessness? Here to help us understand what is being planned and how we can help homeless citizens is Brian Wilson. Brian is the executive director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. On the line from Bethel is Kelly Quartermeyer. Kelly is the director, the executive director of the Bethel Winter House. And Vasna Nu is in the studio with us today, and Vasna is the Youth Advocate and Outreach Coordinator for the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So, Brian, start us off here with an overview of where plans were for providing housing for people this winter, before how long and before the federal shutdown. How were things shaping up this fall, and how has that changed now?
Sure. That's a great question. So our organization, we oversee the homeless planning and response, prevention and response system for Alaska and all communities outside of Anchorage. Unlike Anchorage, many of the communities in rural Alaska have a very limited service array. Here in Anchorage, we see multiple emergency shelters, multiple housing programs, prevention programs. You'll hear from Kelly a little bit later about how in a community like Bethel that serves a very large geographic area, they're limited to just a seasonal emergency shelter and a single supportive housing program and a DV shelter, a lot less resources there. And so the winter time's always a challenge because when it gets cold outside, you can't sleep outside. And so when you don't have a lot of services in your community or don't have any services in your community, say if you're out in a village, what happens is that people take folks in to their homes. And so in many parts of rural Alaska, particularly over the winter time, we see high levels of overcrowding in our communities. And that's just a resource issue that we have, a lack of affordable housing, a lack of housing in general, a lack of services to address the needs of Alaskans. And so it's a tough time. And the people that work out in our remote communities, they move mountains with very little resources. But that's the reality of housing homelessness in rural Alaska for the most part.
So continue on, Brian. In an earlier interview, you mentioned that it's difficult for people who are left without their home because of Typhoon Halong to see themselves or have others see them as homeless.
Yeah.
You said there were questions about why Kuskokwim Region residents were being added to the Homeless Management Information System database. Talk about the sensitivity around this and why it is important to include the folks who suddenly lost their homes.
Sure. I mean, the word homelessness is, or homeless is, it comes with a lot of stigmas around it.
Right.
There's been a lot of conversation.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Yes. There's been a lot of conversation. And instead of it being really about the condition itself of just not having a home, oftentimes that word elicits a lot of other things that oftentimes are unfairly associated to that, to individuals that lost their home. When the typhoon hit, this is a pretty unprecedented event, and it takes time for resources to come online. And when folks were getting displaced from their home communities, you know, we were getting calls from housing providers of, you know, what do we do? You know, like we don't have the ability to serve over 1,000 people that have just showed up in a community. And I'm really excited to talk about the support that's happened after that. But our little tiny role that we could do at that time was to just track where people were. Mm. you know, who of this group of people were living together? What community were they from and where they could move to? Really just basic contact information, nothing about, you know, medical conditions or anything. But the big challenge that we have now is that there's just folks scattered all over the state. We're really hyper-focused on the individuals that came here to Anchorage. But in reality, you know, people went to communities to stay with family. They went to communities to stay with friends. And identifying those individuals and getting them connected to services is paramount right now. That's the most important step that we're at.
So just staying with you a minute longer, Brian, you the hub and spoke system in rural Alaska for regional service, for a regional service community like Bethel, it's sort of the center for about 50 villages. That means that people had no backup resources in their villages and overwhelmed the services in Bethel, leading to people, as you mentioned, being scattered to other communities, including Anchorage and other cities. Do you think there is a way to address this in preparation for future remote disasters to help keep people closer to their home area? Or is the expense just too immense to be thinking about those types of services?
No, I don't think the expense is too expensive, because it actually costs a lot more to treat somebody that's fallen into homelessness in another community. And when people can stay home close to their people that they're connected to their family, to people they grew up with, the success rates of those individuals from a housing standpoint are very high. And it's just a prioritization thing. There are federal formulas that come into play about, you know, how many resources we get from, you know, say HUD or whatnot to stand up new programs. Mm-hmm. And we're really successful at bringing in new resources because our system itself is really successful at housing people. But a lot of the advocacy that we do at the federal level is to talk about, hey, you know, we need to right size the investment in rural communities in general across the country. And in Alaska, you know, when it's more expensive to operate programs, when you aren't connected to road systems in very remote areas, and our region is 660,000 square miles. I think that we just need to see more investment into the success that we've already seen in rural Alaska.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about services for folks who are homeless or maybe at risk of falling into homelessness as winter closes in. In the studio with me today is Brian Wilson. Brian is the executive director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. And also Vasna Nu is in the studio with us today. Vasna is the youth advocate and outreach coordinator for the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. And Kelly Quartermeyer is the executive director of the Bethel Winter House and is on the line with us from Bethel. Kelly, the Bethel Winter House has been a seasonal shelter from October 1st until April 30th. Why not year-round, and how did you settle on that date range?
So the reason that it isn't year-round right now is due to funding. To be able to staff properly to have a reasonable ratio for the people who are in the building to our monitors who are available. We're just not there. And emergency shelter funding has been in and out of availability over the last few years. And so we haven't really been able to expand to a year round, though we do provide laundry and showers when we can during the summer, during the summer days for people to have access to that. We just don't have sleeping. We don't have overnights. So the reason that we decided for seasonal from October 1 to April 30th is actually when Bethel Winter House started. It began on Christmas Eve of 2013, and a church had opened its doors, and it was completely volunteer run because there had been, I believe it was four seasonal deaths the year before due to weather incurred injuries. And so there was a group of individuals in the community that recognized how deadly winter is for folks who are unsheltered here. And we actually just got our first snow a couple of days ago. That's going to be our blanket for the winter. So the reason that we open on the 1st of October is because usually we are starting to see temperatures below freezing by that point. And we're also seeing like freezing fog, snow. It also follows when the river starts to freeze, because we do have a lot of people who come to stay in Bethel for the winter who leave and go stay up and down along the Kuskokwim during the summer, maybe at fish camp or with family in different villages. So it's really the time that we see the most folks in need in Bethel. So we're targeting the highest usage time of the year.
And how has the need changed in terms of how many folks need help in winter? What do you see on an average night now compared to the past?
So as of right now, so October is actually usually our slowest month. We have a lower average of people because people are still filtering in. The river hasn't quite frozen, so some people are still able to boat back and forth or able to plane a little bit easier. We actually have a whole bunch of people on my staff that are stuck helping family in different villages because they can't fly in because they can't land here right now. So travel just becomes a lot more difficult. But we're looking at, so last season we had an average of 54 people a night, which is an increase of about 10 people per night from the 2023 to 2024 season, which from 2022 to 2023, we saw a double in our average. And we foresee that this season will probably follow an increase in that average again. What we did see last year is that there was a decrease in unique individuals, which means that we had more people who were staying more nights. So I think that it's something that, especially because in 2021, Bethel Winter House finally got its own permanent location. As this location continues to be open and more people know about it, the more people are able to access the resources here. And it also, I feel like we are seeing more people who are coming here when overcrowding situations become untenable, because there is somewhere for people to go now in Bethel versus the space that we had previously only allowed for like 20 people, and now we can host up to 72. and we we're seeing folks coming from housing where they're having to sleep in shifts, or they need to move, like they have to go somewhere else because their niece and their nephew have come in and they need somewhere to stay. So that's definitely where I think we're seeing an increase of the of a certain subset of the population that we serve.
All right. Thank you, Kelly, for helping us better understand how the need is growing in your region. Vasna, thank you for being patient. I want to turn to you now. Tell us how you got involved with the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. You started as a volunteer, correct?
Yes. So I first started as a volunteer for our art media camp back last year. Now I'm an hourly employee with the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness starting like a month ago.
What inspired you to want to help out in that way?
One of my biggest inspirations has always been my mom. May she rest in peace. She taught me to love and support everyone no matter their situation and to always accept people for who they are. Before she passed, she dedicated her time to helping youth in the village, Point Hope, Alaska, earn their GEDs and other certifications, giving them tools to build a better future. I'm so grateful to carry on her legacy through the work I do, and I'm grateful.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry that you lost your mom. That's really, really hard, but it's a wonderful thing that you're doing to carry on her legacy, and I know she'd be very proud of you. Tell us about the empowerment events that you host for young people in the Mat-Su. What happens at the coffee and paint events?
Okay, so I host empowerment sessions and like safe spaces where people can truly be themselves while learning motivational and life-building practices. So I basically like have like safe spaces and also have fun events for people, like youth. I feel like it's nice to have like, you know, youth activities.
And do during the events, so clearly there's fun involved, painting and coffee. So these are sober events.
Yes.
Designed to help people, young people realize, I suppose, that you can have a great time without using any substances. But you also do some PowerPoint presentations, correct?
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit. What's going on there?
So I do like empowerments, like slides, like for one, I had done like how to wake up with a good mindset or how to motivate myself to wake up with a good mindset or, you know, like things like that. I feel like that's important. And also like having like a mentorship, and I'm like guiding them to have mentorships and yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you for that. And we will talk more about that in just a bit, but let's go to the phones for a minute. Venetia, I hope I'm saying that correctly. Venetia is in Kenai. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for fitting me in. I'm 68. I'm homeless. I have rehomed food since I was 18. Never did I think I would be in the roles of living out here. I'm in my truck. There's a lot of seniors. There's a whole population of seniors. Cancer, oxygen. We're all living in our vehicles. I have a small two-burner camp stove in the back of my little camper shell. I can make food. There's about a handful of us that I provide food to, free food when I can get it. I'd just like to encourage you guys to make a small difference when you can. You can donate blankets. You can carry socks and blankets. Maybe you can make a difference. The food bank has an Adopt a Turkey. You can call up with a few dollars and put that towards a turkey, and somebody will get a turkey this holiday. Just anything to make a difference where you can. They're hiding literally in tents in the woods, and they're scared. You know, we're all scared, but I'm blessed. I've got a truck. And just make a difference when you can.
Well, Venetia, I'm sorry that you're having this struggle in your life. I can't imagine. I'm close to your age. I can't imagine living in my vehicle in my 60s. And are there services in Kenai that you've gone to try to see
Yes.
about other types of housing?
Yes. I'm running from a monster. This is my third one in a row, and I'm afraid to live. The last one was 5 years of stalking and horrible. He was a landlord. I'm afraid to live in one place. Mm. I'm afraid to live in one place. I feel safer in my truck. My heater went out. I'm getting that fixed today, but I'm safer in my truck. And I am making a little bit of a difference out here because I found people in places I didn't even know people could be. And free food's getting harder to get. So God's got me. He's got my truck stapled, taped, and glued together. It's a 93 Mazda. And I have it a lot better than a whole bunch of people. I'm just encouraging everybody, make a difference when you can. Find a way. Don't wait for it to be presented. Find a way to do it.
All right, Venetia, thank you for the call. And I hope that you are able to find some stability and make it through this upcoming winter okay. Please take good care of yourself.
I do feel stable. Thank you.
All right. Take care. That is a tough story to hear. An elder living in a 1993 truck doesn't at all sound stable. Brian and Kelly, the federal shutdown has gone on for nearly a month now. SNAP benefits, also known as food stamps, will not go out to people next week if Congress doesn't find consensus and open things up. We know that many people, we just heard from Venetia living in her truck. We know that many people live paycheck to paycheck and the lack of food assistance could put them behind financially. Yesterday, I live in Airport Heights and the Catholic Social Services building there has pantry hours. Yesterday, I saw a long line of cars at the Catholic Social Services building waiting for boxes of food. Already, people are struggling. What are your concerns for next week if people can't get SNAP assistance?
It's a pretty dire situation, and I just want to go back to the caller there, Venetia. I don't know if I can get their contact information after this at all, but it'd be great to get in touch with them. But that story that you just heard is something that plays out all over the state. And to see somebody who is, and hear from somebody who is literally experiencing homelessness, living out of their car with the winter months ahead, calling up to encourage people to help and helping herself for people in an even worse situation, I don't think that story gets told enough. We were talking earlier about stereotypes around people experiencing homelessness. You know, that's the reality. The community really comes together to help one another. And when there aren't resources or somebody's unique situation is, you know, keeping them from finding a good place to live, you know, it's a hard one to hear. It is. And so with the shutdown, you know, the SNAP benefits is just one more thing. We get asked a lot, you know, why do people fall into homelessness? You know, what is the root cause of homelessness? And I wish I could say, you know, it's just this one thing. Right. Like it's just, you know, mental health illness or something, right? That would be easy. You could invest in one thing and you could solve a problem. But in reality, it's multifaceted and people are stretched very, very thin. And so the SNAP benefits ending here in a couple of days has me gravely concerned because that's just one more thing, a decision that Alaskans are having to make, that people, Americans are having to make, of with the limited resources I have, am I putting it towards putting food on the table for my children? Or am I putting it towards rent? Or am I putting it for that delayed car repair that I need so I can get to work? And so these things, while it may not be a housing resource, will have housing impacts down the line. And our food bank system, as great as they are, cannot make up for the loss of that kind of benefit. I was just reading the other day that for every meal that a food bank provides, SNAP provides 9. And we hear about food banks running out of food all the time. In my community in Juneau, there's one just a couple blocks down, and they're always posting on Facebook, you know, please bring donations, please bring donations. And just like Venetia said, at this time more than ever, if people are trying to find a way to help, that's one way to do it. But we cannot sustain those benefits, you know, coming off the table at all. I mean, at all.
Kelly, yeah. Kelly, weigh in here. Your concern about both SNAP benefits, and then if people can't get food assistance, they're going to turn more to the food banks, and they will be depleted much faster. What are you hoping people do, Kelly?
Yeah, it's something that because we provide a dinner and a breakfast, and so we've actually been trying to figure out how, because we foresee an increase in people utilizing that service specifically, but something with our food bank, we probably had it. I mean, before the pandemic, the food bank was probably seeing maybe 250 to 300 folks who were signed up. And I believe the last number that I heard for utilizers for last year was 2,000. And so the food bank has been seeing an exponential increase in our region anyways.
So you're saying the numbers went from 200 to 2,000?
Yes. Oh, yes.
That's stunning.
It's very common for our food bank to run out of a certain section of the, of what they're providing, and can only provide maybe 2/3 of the like meal set that they have, because there's so many people that they're trying to serve. They were able to do a pop-up because they had additional resources that had come in, but it's so in Bethel, because of the cost of living, the income level is, I think it's 50,000 is people who are eligible for some form of food assistance. It might not be a ton, but that's kind of where the line starts. And that is at least half of the community. Mm. I barely make over that. I know people who are in high-level admin positions that make at that level, who are technically eligible for assistance. And so it's the impact. We run the permanent supportive housing units. We have 22 people that are currently living in there, and every single person utilizes SNAP. And so I foresee, especially with not knowing when it's going to be remedied and if this is just going to be skipped, or what exactly is going to happen, even though there is funding that could carry this over. It's not just the federal shutdown. Like, there's the other factors that go into it of like withholding funds that are allocated for things already. That we're seeing that is going to continue to be a great impact.
All right. You heard there, folks, that these organizations are definitely going to need help as we head into our first break of the program. Please consider helping your local food banks, your local shelters. And we know that most organizations, relief organizations, say that cash is best, because then they can get the things that they know people most need. But all donations, of course, especially food donations at this time, are welcome. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking today about homelessness services as winter closes in, and there are a myriad of overlapping problems in this moment. The federal government shutdown, food assistance programs, uncertain about when they'll get the help that they need. It's a time for Alaskans to step up and help each other. In the studio with me today is Brian Wilson, the Executive Director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, And Vasna Nu is the Youth Advocate and Outreach Coordinator for the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. On the line from Bethel is Kelly Quartermeyer. Kelly is the Executive Director of the Bethel Winter House. Vasna, I want to turn back to you for a moment. The empowerment events that you host, your family is from Point Hope, right?
Yes.
So are you focused primarily on Indigenous youth for these empowerment events, or talk about what you're trying to achieve there?
Yeah, so I definitely want to reach out to the rural communities for sure in Point Hope, Alaska. I believe it's important to have like trauma-informed mentors and with like lived experience such as myself supporting our rural communities. Looking ahead, I want to expand and bring more empowerment events to the youth in the rural communities so we can have more mentorship and like just more. I feel like in the villages, we don't have those things, you know, and we lack so many resources such as like, you know, mentorship and therapy or like safe spaces. And I feel like if I bring it out there, it would make a difference, you know.
And so are you thinking about sort of a hybrid setup of maybe some people on the ground in the community, but also Zoom and statewide discussion?
Yes, I work with a lot of Zoom, or I do hybrids. Like I'll have it on Zoom there or like have people come join in person, like both. I definitely want to do more in person. I feel like it's better to, like for me, like as a youth, I feel like it's better to interact with people in person so I can like actually feel them and like hear them out for real, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what are you trying to help young people build and prepare for with these events? More connection to others, healthier activities and mindsets, all of the above?
I want to be able to be a voice for our Indigenous communities and like being able to like have them speak up and be able to do the things that I'm doing, you know, like through their trauma experiences, like things that they've been through. Like, I feel like, you know, they're quieter and, you know, not very outspoken. And I feel like I want to be that person to uplift them and out let them speak and have a voice, you know.
Well, that is truly admirable. And I'm really glad that you're doing this work. I know that it's probably hugely beneficial to a lot of other young people. So thank you for doing that. Brian, I'm going to turn back to you now. What are the overall numbers of Alaskans currently that are without stable housing, and how does that compare to maybe a decade ago?
Sure. So if you look statewide, just under 15,000 people this last year accessed some sort of homeless service, whether that be supportive housing, emergency shelter, prevention programs. Looking at, you know, Anchorage versus the rest of the state, it's about a 60-40 split in that number, with about 60% of that accessing services in Anchorage and 40 in other communities across. For folks experiencing literal homelessness, it's just under 10,000 individuals over this last year were logged in our system. And
unique individuals, or is that sometimes folks who come back for services, or is that 10,000?
That's unduplicated. Wow. Individuals. So it's a lot. And I always put an asterisk around those numbers because you have to remember that we can only count people where we have services. So we know in many communities, as we've heard earlier, that they're full of homes that are considered severely overcrowded. And what that means is, more than one person per room.
Yeah.
Not bedroom, but room, kitchen, living room, dining room. And so those folks in many communities and in many instances may try to access services if they were available, and we would capture that number. But because they're actually in just the homes and there's no services there, we can't send that number up to the federal government demonstrating that need for homelessness support, which is part of the problem why we see underfunding in rural communities.
Because you can't capture the full scope of...
Yeah, if you're in a severely overcrowded home, you don't meet the HUD federal definition of homelessness, which is incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no number that's sort of a cap for overcrowding that the federal government looks at?
So, well, they do look at it, and it plays into other types of programs, but in terms of the homeless response, it doesn't for the programs that we operate that pay for things like supportive housing and rapid rehousing, rental assistance programs. So it's a big number. I think folks struggle to conceptualize what that means and the amount of resources that are needed to go into that. And it's I also want to mention, though, that that number is looking over an entire year. So if you look at like today, like a capture this moment in time, that number is going to be a lot lower because we have really successful programs that are really good at housing people. But we talk about homelessness all the time as if it's this like static population, when in reality, people are flowing through the system and they're getting housed. And more often than not, when they're housed, they aren't returning to homelessness. But what we don't talk enough about is the inflow. And so when we're mentioning things like SNAP benefits going away and people getting stretched thin, you know, all these things factor into increasing the inflow. One of our board members likens it to a ship that's taking on water and we're trying to bail out water.
Yeah.
And we're always so focused on like, get a better bail out there, get a bigger bailer out there, instead of focusing on fixing the boat and those issues. And so that's what we talk a lot about. And it's a difficult message to convey sometimes because it really is healthcare and housing and food security and all of these different things, income levels that really need to be addressed as opposed to just throw more money into homelessness.
Right, right. Kelly, you had mentioned earlier resourceful people who found other places to go, family or friends in other communities. And that means, as Brian was just talking about, that they're not known about by people who have resources. How difficult is it, and are you trying to find those folks now to help them in the longer term?
Yeah. So just before I answer that, I have a couple of stats that I wanted to share specifically about like overcrowding in the Chalista region, which is the Bethel region. It's in a census done by Alaska Financial Housing Corporation. 39% of homes, this was in 2018, had overcrowding or severe overcrowding. And we know that that number has increased. There has just not been an in-depth census. And of the homes in this region, a third of them don't have complete bathrooms. And another third of them don't have complete kitchens. So it's something to remember that some of these folks are living in houses that don't technically meet certain standards, but they don't know that because that's what they've always lived in. So to answer your original question, yes, we are trying to get the word out. We're working on getting contacts in all of the villages because up and down the Kuskokwim, because we know that there are people in that have just scattered, in making sure that we are sending out the message and getting contact information in the hands of people to be able and telling them that there's these resources are available. We also have, there's a few events that come up that Bethel hosts every year. That's a project, Homeless Connect. And we are going to kind of restructure that a little bit to also include the, for folks to be able to access resources that have been displaced by Typhoon Halong. So we're reorganizing some of the things that we already do in community to be able to serve those folks who are experiencing that acute disaster, and trying to this is kind of like what Brian was saying. We were reorganizing the resources that we already have to try and serve a new influx of folks and be able to try and find as many people as possible.
And I believe that when we were in an earlier interview, Kelly, you noted that the Chulista region, the Bethel area, has the highest level of overcrowding in the state. So that's really something to keep in mind. We need to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about homelessness services to help folks who are without housing as winter begins and how folks can help their neighbors as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Vasna, what do you think are, when you think about homelessness for young people compared to older adults, are there things that you think differ for a young person that are extra concerns?
Yeah, I feel like, are you talking about like indigenous?
Just any young people. Regions? Yeah, okay. Young people, yeah, that are struggling with being homeless.
I feel like they're kind of similar to adults, but I feel like for youth homelessness, I feel like we definitely need more mentorship and like someone that can guide them through the way and like check up on them throughout the way. I feel like that's important instead of just like, oh, here's this resource and then not check up with them. You know, I feel like that is very important. And also like having these life building practices, like such as the empowerments that I do, I feel like those are important for the youth homelessness too, so they can have those built-in practices in them.
And gaining trust,
yes,
with someone like a mentor, so that there's a trusted person that they can turn to for solid advice and answers.
Yes, for sure.
Thank you. Let's talk a bit about, we know that we've been talking about overcrowding in many places, Brian and Kelly, and a lot of people are certainly stepping up in the immediate sense to help out. But as winter drags on, it can add pressure to families to be in a strange place with few resources. Maybe now there's overcrowding in other homes because people have graciously opened their doors. How are you thinking about that, and what do you want people to know about getting help when they may need additional assistance or to change the situation that they're in?
Yeah, I think you're right there that this isn't just like an immediate short-term response, that this is going to take time. The communities that got displaced already were in a housing crisis prior to losing even more homes.
Yeah.
And so the response, the encouraging thing here is that Alaskans run towards the problem to help solve the problem. I can't speak enough to the amazing efforts that we've seen from our tribal leaders in the state, ANTHC, South Central Foundation, CITC, the Heritage Center, getting food flown out all over the state to help people, school districts coming together to get kids enrolled into new districts so they can continue. It's in the middle of the school year and have some normalcy. And then our really strong state leadership through our Housing Finance Corporation, who's, you know, scrambling to stand up new disaster housing voucher programs that can help both renters and homeowners. And that it's a really strong team. It's a team that I feel really confident in. And are looking at this as a temporary situation and a long-term situation, depending on, you know, what the families, you know, how their homes were affected, you know, back in the villages. If there's anybody that's listening to this that is in need of assistance or displaced, or think they may be in need of assistance at any future time, it's so important that they go to the state EOC's website where they can fill out all of the individual assistance forms. There's multiple forms, state, FEMA, housing stuff, and that's at ready.alaska.gov. ready.alaska.gov.
We'll link to that as well,
yeah,
with the Talk of Alaska post.
And if you don't have connectivity, you can even call 1-844-445-7131. So that's for folks who are affected. But as community members, if you want to help out in this effort, the Alaska Community Foundation on their website has a donation form, alaskacf.org. You've probably seen that link floating around. But really, back to what you were saying, in terms of community, you know, we have over 1,000 people that lost their community. They didn't just lose their home, their snow machine, you know, their food storage.
All their possessions.
Yeah. They lost their sense of community. They were ripped away from it, what they do on a daily basis, what they look at. And so if you're in a community like Anchorage or somewhere else and you see families that have been displaced and rehoused in a temporary long-term, it's so important that we embrace them and find ways to get them engaged in community and feel welcomed, because this is a really traumatic situation to be in. And you know, we can rebuild homes, we can buy new snow machines, but you can't replace community. And
so true. And it's going to be a very long road to healing and solace for folks who have lost not only their possessions, but as you noted, their sense of their very community and being close to relatives and things that people have been used to for generations. Kelly, the federal disaster declaration has now been approved. We know that there will be $25 million, possibly more. There could be, the door to individual assistance is also open, but we don't know how much that will ultimately be. You noted that those funds won't go far. Talk about your concerns for that level of funding.
So $25 million is very little, especially considering that $20 million was cut in the budget earlier this year for flood prevention in those areas specifically. So it's $25 million, just for reference, there were three houses that were built in Bethel for $2.1 million, and that was done on a budget. And they are three bedroom, one bath homes, about 1,200 square feet. And the requirements for building in the tundra in riverbed is we build on pylons. There's to be able to adjust and deal with the shifting of the ground. And so when you look at having to not just rebuild homes, individuals to rebuild homes, when you're looking at rebuilding complete infrastructure, when you're having to completely rebuild your road systems, your fuel, your water, all of the infrastructure that has to be redone. And even if there are homes that that can just be, you know, refitted, remodeled, things that are, their structures are still standing, that's getting resources up and down the river, especially right now. That means that you're going to have to fly them in. You're not going to be able to barge them up the river maybe like you would have if this had been something that had happened 6 months ago, which instantly takes this into something that is going to be, in this time of year, is going to be at least double, if not triple, what it would have been if you had been able to plan and have it shipped out on barge. Because a lot of these places only have room in their airports for smaller planes. So it's the reality is that $25 million is a number that is completely unrealistic.
Too low,
especially considering the lack of funds just like we were talking about, if that 20 million had gone in, what would this look like? What type of, how many people could we have kept from being displaced? How many homes could we have saved? I mean, Bethel by itself hasn't seen any type of state program retrofitting in almost 20 years. And I'm sure that it's even worse in up and down the river. I don't have those exact numbers. It's just one of those things that we continue to see that.
It's a big challenge. And we only have a couple of minutes left here. I did want to get one more question to you, Kelly, and then I want to turn to Brian here in our last minute. Lots of people, as we noted, have lost everything, their important papers, birth certificates, driver's license. You're working to help people with recovering those documents. How can they find out about that?
Yeah, so at that Project Homeless Connect, which it will be on that is the one thing I forgot to look up. Let me look it up really quick.
Well, and we can get that information and link to it to post show. And if you want to look for that while Brian's adding some comments here, that would be great. And maybe we can jump back to you then.
Sure. Yeah. Just wanted to hop in about the need there. The local tribally designated housing entity in Bethel, the Association of Village Council Presidents, ABCP, they did a housing needs and cost assessment at the village level prior to the disaster. This one or two years ago. They estimate before any damage in Kipnuk alone, there was $45 million of need to address the current overcrowding and housing problem in just that village. Regionally, for their entire region, they identified nearly $2 billion, billion with a B, of need there. So, I know that we heard that the first $25 million might just be a down payment and more to come, and I really sincerely hope so, but there was already a severe overcrowding and rehab, the conditions of the homes needing to be rehabilitated before the disaster, and now it's just exponentially worse in a lot of communities.
You know, we know that was damage before Halong. Kotzebue had been hit hard by a storm, so had parts of Nome earlier. Mm-hmm. A Kotzebue resident speaking at a recent Kotzebue City Council meeting said, it seems like there's plenty of money to respond to emergencies and fix things like we're doing now, making a lot of erosion repairs, but it seems harder to get the money for preventative measures before disasters happen. Why do you think that is?
You know, I wish I had the answer to that question. I think political will is an interesting thing, but it's always interesting when you see, say, like a hurricane hit down in Louisiana, and you see the overhead shot of the helicopters. You know, that those conditions are often experienced every day in many of these communities, and it's something we need to address.
Kelly, were you able to find that information quickly?
Yes. So it's on November 4th, which is a week from today, at 12 to 2, the Cultural Center here in Bethel, which is the same as the library. It's in the same building.
All right.
We will have access to computers there, and we'll be able to help folks fill out Social Security,
great,
their birth certificate, stuff like that.
All right, thanks so much. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Brian Wilson and Vasna Nu with the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness in our studio today, and Kelly Quartermeyer, the Executive Director of Bethel Winterhouse. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. Our editor is Annie Feit, and Ava White helped us on the phones today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for helping. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.